come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the biggest problems faced by the U.S. military over the last 50 years, from Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan, is the misunderstanding of local culture. At least in World War II, when our soldiers went into France and then Germany and Italy, we at least had a shared European background, most of us, or at least I should say my father's and his, our fathers and grandfathers. But that's not the case when American soldiers show up in Southeast Asia or in the Middle East. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who's turning that experience in conflict zones into advice for corporate management. He is a management consultant who honed his skills advising military commanders on how to partner with locals and overcoming those cultural differences. He's a chief cultural consultant for Culturasec, co-host of the Break It Down Show, a podcast online at breakitdownshow.com, and a public speaker. His website, peteaturner.com. We welcome Pete Turner to the program. Pete?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about what brought you into conflict zones in the first place. You know, my upbringing was essentially, you know, you're going to go to college and then you're going to get a degree and then you're going to go out and get a job. You know, I grew up, as you did, in the era of the volunteer military.
Sure.
And my dad missed out on Korea only because he busted an ankle playing softball just before he got drafted. And that was the time that they were winding down Korea anyway. But his older brothers served. His father served in World War One. I've got ancestors who served in the military going all the way back to the pre-revolution days. I'm the first generation of my family that kind of missed out on that. But what was it about your upbringing that led you to Iraq and Afghanistan and trying to figure out how to overcome cultural differences that are real obstacles to our soldiers?
It's funny that you ask, because when you look back, as you know, someone who's middle-aged, and you can see the path, but when you were on it, you had no idea, you know, that when you made this left turn or when you climbed over this boulder that you'd be in this totally different spot that made no sense at the time.
Right.
So I grew up in California, no real military presence in my family. I had an uncle who was sort of distant from the family who was in, but that created no influence for me. So it was nowhere near my radar, and I was on a college prep track growing up. You know, I had worked a lot and everything else, got a college degree, and just, it was the early 90s, and it was really a rough time to find a job.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, I had the problem of being, and I'll just be candid about this. At the time, I was a TV radio degreed person. I was trying to get a job, but every job potential thing came with, what are you? Are you this ethnicity? Are you this gender? And I'm a white guy. There's just a lot of white dudes in that business already. And so the market corrected to, yeah, and rightfully so, to create more diversity. So,
well, and that was about the time I was getting out of broadcasting. It was also at a time when deregulation from the Reagan years had,
yeah,
you know, it used to be they could only, broadcast companies could only own 7 AM and 7 FM stations and 7 TV stations.
Sure.
And
yeah,
now you've got companies like iHeartMedia and Cumulus and that are owning 1,500 stations. So suddenly, and that with the growth of computer technology, suddenly, mm-hmm, one guy sitting here in the Ozarks can do three radio shows across the country from his, you know, without ever leaving his bedroom. There were far fewer jobs, and right, and as diversity took in, guys who look like you and me were not at the top of the list.
At the time, I was pretty bitter about it because, you know, you just don't have the context of age and everything. But, you know, when you look back, you're like, yeah, you know, that market correction needed to happen. And so,
yeah,
I everything I could do to find that job, you know, I couldn't do it. So one day I was pushing carts in the rain at Costco and I said, enough's enough. You know, I can't find a job because I have no experience. I don't have any experience, so I can't find a job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I'm going to go to the military because they'll make sure I get experience. And I became a spy. And, which oddly enough is part sales job and it's part communication. So it suited my skill set well. And I started interviewing people, you know, which sounds like what we do on the Break It Down Show and what you do in your show. You know, we had this perfect marriage of my skills. So I get to go out and be personable and talk to people and win friends and start to find things out in combative situations. So that's what I did as a counterintelligence agent in the Army. Just I gathered friends. I built a network. And even now, I'm in Dallas today visiting a long, long, long time friend, but I have friends all over the nation. So by accident, I became a spy, and those my natural skill set, what I'd done, what I built was perfect for it. So I was good at it, and I was good at finding things out. And to transition that into what I did as a human terrain person is, even as a spy, I focused on threat, but a lot of times threat wasn't really the problem. It was more like, hey, these 25,000 people would be a whole lot happier and stable if they had X. And it doesn't mean necessarily a well, but like there's a 10-foot wide pothole that makes them all drive out of their comfort area, out of their village, and they have to go, through this foreign village, you know, opposing village, and that causes conflict for both sides. If we could fill that pothole with some extra dirt, you know, because we have earth movers, then we can potentially calm that area down. Mm-hmm. And so those types of things became a lot more powerful than the actual, where are the bombs? You know, because at some point, there are only so many bombs, only so many bad guys, and the more you chase and flush out the bad guys, the more bad guys you create. So that led to my transitioning into more of this cultural norm business that I'm in, and trying to find ways to help commanders, help leaders see the existing cultural paths that take them to the goal that they want. But because they're not from that area or familiar with the customs, they simply can't see. Those things are invisible to them.
Hmm. One of the things, and this is why I was happy that a mutual friend, Dr. Tim Furnish, who will be a guest next week on this program, by the way, put us in contact with one another, was because of a book I recently read about the history of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, The Pentagon's Brain by Annie Jacobson, which I highly recommend. She wrote that DARPA began investigating this type of approach to overcoming these cultural differences back during Vietnam, but they were deploying, right, you know, anthropologists, professional scholars. Mm-hmm. You come at this from a kind of a different background. How would you say your perspective on this would differ from somebody coming at this from an academic background?
Well, that's a great question, because the program that I worked with was the progeny of that program. It was called the Human Terrain System. And the difference between myself, who's not an academic, though I have a master's degree and everything else, is that I understand command intent and mission, whereas the cultural anthropologist looks at, well, frankly, they trained us to look at it like this. This is a research environment. And I would say, no, this is a combat environment. This is an area of operations, and we're all beholden to that commander to allow them to enforce their intent, their will upon that environment. So I am not there to do anything other than to make sure that commander has all of my best effort to create the outcome they're trying to create. That's my job. My job is not to go out and study goat farmers. And so I don't need a syllabus. I don't need a rubric to go know what to do. I know my job is to constantly produce information that influences command decisions. And if I'm not doing that, I'm irrelevant. And if I'm irrelevant, I'm eating chow and I'm making a mess, and we're taking up resources that can be given to somebody who's going to help affect the command intent. So that's the difference, is I speak commander, and a lot of my peers didn't.
How did these cultural differences manifest in unnecessary challenges for commanders in the field?
There's things that are invisible to commanders, because they just, like, again, a commander's job is to impose his will, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is when you go to somewhere like Afghanistan or Iraq, and you're trying to stand up a government, at some point, and this will be the quote from one of my Afghan partners, there's only room for one sword in a scabbard.
That's a great saying.
Right. And so he's talking directly to my commander, and I have to write this down for my commander to say, hey, you know, at some point we have to transition and be less of a partner and more as a mentor, and let these guys put their sword in the scabbard. And instead of imposing your will, sir, and to a man, every time I met a commander, I would say, you know, I would ask on purpose, what do you want me to do? What's the one question I can answer? And they would say, tell me who the people are that are most influential in this area. And I would, having just got there, I would say every time, I know who the most influential person is in this area. It's not a problem. I'll tell you right now. And they would say, okay, who is it, wise ass, right? And I would say, sir, it's you. And until you can bring back your influence, we can't even allow the native system to work. We're overriding all of the power structures, you know, the elder networks, those things that have always worked traditionally for them. You know, we always talk about, oh, there's corruption over there, like, but we are corruption. We come and corrupt the systems. We put money in where money never was supposed to be. And some of that stuff you have to do, but you do it by choice, not by design. So I would give commanders tools, like I would say, is this Afghan inspired? Is this Afghan led? And is this Afghan provisioned? And if it's not, you're a commander. You do what the heck you want to do. But if it's our idea, you're already corrupting. And if they're not leading it, well, now we're forcing. And if they're not provisioning it, well, now we're just, you know, they're going to be passive aggressive with us. They're going to let us do whatever we want to do. And we're completely out of the cultural norm, which again, sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes you have to say, this will happen. You guys will adapt to this. But the norm shouldn't be that. That should be by exception, by command exception.
Hmm. Did you get any sense from any of the elders that you met in Afghanistan who might have been there when Russia was there at how well the Russians made use of these techniques?
Yeah, you know, you deal a lot with the people that have had experience with Russians. And though they fought the Russians, a lot of the military doctrine that stuck was Russian-based because they have a very powerful top-down approach where, you don't make a decision without your leader telling you what to do. And that's common in conflict zones. You don't want to be the one that stands up and says, I know what to do, if that's not your role. That will get you killed. That'll bring harm to your family. So they're already a cloistered society. They're already a conservative society. So this Russian model of one leader telling a thousand, it really works well for them. It makes them comfortable. So they follow that. So there's a lot of remnants of the Russian era with that. But there's also a lot of Mujahideen fighters who look at the Russian thing, and that's the proudest moment of their life because they went after, you know, the world's biggest force in a full-on pitched battle. And they won. Mm-hmm. And gosh, who wouldn't be proud of that?
Yeah, yeah. And so I was curious about that because you mentioned a passive aggressive approach, and I just wonder if sometimes we fail to learn from the mistakes of our enemies, much as well as ourselves. The Russians probably weren't hindered by the rules of engagement that our soldiers operate under, and yet they weren't able to dominate and pacify the country after 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if looking at that, if there are those in our military who said, you know, maybe committing to this is not such a good idea.
I'll give you an illustration as to how complex this is. So we were partnered with a Romanian army unit, right? And they owned a little piece of battle space. They worked underneath our overall guidance, but they had autonomy in their area. And so we were sent out, my research partner, Dr. Richard Lede, and I were sent to this area with kind of a tasking of, there's something weird going on. It's not going the way we want it to go. Can you illustrate what happened? And this is what I do for companies a lot. I don't really know what's going on, but I'm not getting what I want. What do you see? So we went out and looked, and one of the things we found out was that the Afghans were saying, why are the Russians here? And we said, what Russians? And they said, those guys in those uniforms, those are Russians. And so we said, okay, you know, and the common thing would be say, no, those are Romanians, and fix the problem, right? But that doesn't fix the problem. So
right,
we said,
right.
Tell us about these Russians. And they said, well, they go on patrols and they drive over people, they crush things, and you know, they're a hazard, they're a menace. And so we were able to take this back to the command, who that clearly is not the intent. And we talked to the Romanian commander, and he's like, yeah, well, we're doing a counterinsurgency operation, and that's how we do it with a bit of force. And we said, well, they think you guys are the Russians and that you're invading. And the guy said, my goodness, that's not what I want. So here you have this whole doctrinal base and mission that the Romanians had. And in a blink of an eye, they realized that the impact that they were having was not going to net the result that they were going for. And, you know, I don't necessarily know the answer to how you fix that, but I know that you start there. You start to figure out how do we do this partnering better, because this is not what anybody wants out of this situation.
Hmm. In hearing you describe your role in Afghanistan, it strikes me that there are some aspects that are similar to the 4 years that I spent in outside sales, in which you have to find out what the people in the field want, and then you have to turn around and explain to the folks back at the warehouse. Mm-hmm. You know, the guys in the warehouse are actually shearing and forming the metal. The drivers who have to transport it and make sure it gets where it's supposed to be without getting all scratched up. Or perhaps when you take this turn, make sure you don't cut it too short and accidentally drive over the guy's culvert because he's really ticked off about the other company they quit buying from. Right. And how do you convince the folks back in the office, the inside salesperson who has to handle the a customer who may be a little crotchety? How much of your effort was spent in trying to sell yourself on the American commanders for whom you were working?
You know, I would say, honestly, the bulk of my effort is in doing that, in creating influence. And this is where the mass comm comes in. So I write these reports that I built by talking to commanders and saying, what do you need to see in these reports? Now, my peers would write 40-page opuses that wouldn't get read by anybody. They look great down the road somewhere. But today, right now, that mission that I went on, where is the result of that? That's what commanders need to see to have influence. So you've got to, one, build a body of, you have to create content, right? That's what we all do now. We create content. Mm-hmm. But someone has to listen to that content, and you have to mass communicate. So I'd send my reports out, and I would send them out to these officers, and I would say, hey, what do you think? And they'd say, oh, it's great. And if I allowed that to be good enough, I would think I was great and have no result. But I kept building, kept saying, hey, I sent you that report, and then they would say, yeah, I read it, it was good. And I'm like, you know, the commander's reading these things, whether that was true or not is just debatable. But I would say that, and I would slowly build this readership, and I would listen carefully for my words to leak out into the planning meetings. Mm-hmm. So that I knew that now they, in fact, are reading, because they would say that it's the military. They're going to not do anything they don't have to do.
Well, that's human nature.
Right? So if I write papers and think everybody's reading them, I can slap myself on the back and think I won the war. But the reality is you have to work very hard to create an audience. And so I would create this audience, and I wouldn't take, you know, yeah, I read your report and it was great. I would say, okay, great. How does it shaping what you're doing a day to day? And they'd be like, ah, all right, Pete, you got me. I'm not reading them, you know? Because you have to ask that next question. I'm a question asker. That's what I do. So I had to constantly create influence. And that's in the command and staff area. Now I'm going to go out to the side of a mountain as a middle-aged guy that probably weighs a few pounds too much. And I have a world of knowledge in my head, but I'm not them. And so I've got to, just like I have to with the Afghans or the Iraqis, I've got to be able to integrate into their culture. So, you know, even though I may not work out as much as they do, they'll see me in the gym with my shirt off. I'm working out, and, you know, they're like, dang, Pete's like us. You know, the other mm-hmm. thing is I would bring ice cream. Well, I'd find and ice cream's a powerful tool for me in general. I use it in every direction that I can because everybody loves ice cream.
Yeah.
So, I would bring ice cream to these remote sites where people would say, like, I would hear the grumblings because they don't hide it. They're infantry guys. They're like, oh, that guy over there, you know, beard and civilian clothes, probably gets paid $1 million a year, and rah, 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 grumble, grumble. And then the staff sergeant or the sergeant first class would say, hey, you guys enjoying that ice cream? They would do it for my benefit to let everybody know, like, well, that guy right there brought it. And so my integration into that unit was, I wasn't Mr. Turner. I was Pete. And when I became Pete, then they got it, you know, and I would just subtly mentor guys, you know, like, one thing you never do on a combat patrol is you don't go, oh my God, I'm so hot.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all hot. We all know we're all carrying something. So like if a guy was, if I could see he was struggling or just, you know, just in general, I would just go, hey man, why don't you give me that belt of ammo for a while and I'll take it off your back just to be part of them. I'm part of their tribe, you know, HR is a tribe. Engineering is a tribe, all these different areas. They're all tribes. That's how I look at it. So you don't try to be them. You try to understand them. I understand that this ammo belt is heavy. Let me carry it for you for a few minutes. Yeah, I'm not going to say I'm an infantry guy. That's the thing about culture. is you're better off not faking like you're from Japan, but saying, hey, I'm different than you, but I want to understand. And then it's a better path. Yeah. Things, like the military likes to teach us some basic phrases to say, right? I'd rather you learn how to use an interpreter at an expert level than to spend 2 weeks learning how to say 15 phrases and that's the end of your conversation, you know?
Yeah.
So use your inexperience in that cultural setting to say, I don't know, but I am interested. And who doesn't want to teach you about their culture?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So,
now I'm laughing because I found that to be absolutely true. The territory I covered as an outside sales rep was the southern half of Illinois, and mainly the southern third, which is heavily dependent on coal mining and oil, which I had no, I had no clue about that. But I grew up in Chicago, so what I tell these guys is, you know, when I meet them the first time, well, you know, I'm from Chicago, so you have to forgive me. I grew up thinking the world ended at Interstate 80. So, speak slowly, use small words, and help me understand. What challenges you guys face? Yeah, and I said, and by the way, on behalf of Chicago, we're sorry about that Obama thing. And that kind of broke the ice a little bit. So I grasp what you're saying, and the common sense of it, you know, really rings true.
Right.
I guess the big question I have to ask then is, why did this take a special initiative by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency to begin to instill this as part of the military culture?
They haven't. Ultimately, that's the real answer. Is what roots we struggle with this. We think of culture. We struggle to define culture. And here's what I've learned through my experience. And this isn't that I know more than everybody else. I've just seen things and been able to put together a system. So culture is like gravity. It's everywhere. It's omnipresent. It's sort of like God. Like God is culture. Like wherever you look, you are seeing culture. And if you don't look at it in that fact, think about this at gravity. Right? You drop your keys. You're like, oh man. Like gravity just hits you in the belly. And it's a little thing, but culture is constantly doing the same thing. It's constantly giving you signals on what's going on. And if you're not willing to see it, it's going to have its impact no matter what you do. So that's tough for anybody, let alone a military organization, to adjust for. So organizationally speaking, the military is very smart at certain things. And the example I always use is basic rifle marksmanship, BRM.
Mm-hmm.
And a staff sergeant, someone with 5-6 years in the military, can lay down next to me, a brand new private, and teach me how to shoot. And they can look at the paper, the holes in the paper where I've shot, and they can say, your breathing is wrong, you know, or your finger is not put on the right spot of the trigger. Hyper detailed feedback and coaching. Well, when it comes to culture, we don't have that. We have the same card that we had 100 years ago that says, don't make the okay gesture here. But how do I leverage that? I don't know what to do with that. So someone like me, I'm valuable because I can say, look, there are things that already work here. Like we have a rule of law, for example, and we'll want to impact rule of law because that creates, quote unquote, stability where we're from. But the reality is they have a rule of law system. So if you intend to change their rule of law and improve their situation, you have to understand rule of law, which is an element of culture, and whatever it is that we do. I just presented a paper on female empowerment. I can't presume to improve the condition of females in a conflict zone until I understand what their life is. And in the case of Afghanistan, if you don't know your Benedicte Grima and you haven't read her book, you have no business changing a Pashtun woman's life. You cannot do it well. And that doesn't sit with any giant organization. Well, like IBM is going to go and they're going to do what IBM does, right? It's not just the military. It's any corporation. They're going to bring their culture, their solution to an area where I'll give you an example that's more regional and colloquial. So, let's say there's another Hurricane Katrina and then it comes into Terrebonne Parish in the most southern part of Louisiana. They don't need FEMA. They already know how to do this. They already survive.
Right.
You know, they'll take the help. But you're more likely to anger them because you don't understand how they do it. They've done it. They live in the same spot for 200 years at a time. They know how to withstand a hurricane. And they rebuild, and it sucks and everything else. But when you come in and presume to give them a solution, you're going to receive a negative response because you've ignored their reality and you haven't taken the time to say, hey, what do you need help with? And a lot of times what I'm finding is that it's a simple thing. It's not this grand multi-million dollar solutions that give them what they need. It's something very, very, very simple. Something as simple as moving dirt that they can't move, or, you know, things that are quick and easy and constant progress. Otherwise, it's too grand, it takes too long, and it's too easy to screw up on any of the 155 million steps that it takes to do a grand solution.
Hmm. And again, this is ringing true with my own experience. I saw when I was back in broadcasting in the 80s, early 90s, radio station groups that would say, well, you know, we are a top 40 or we are an album rock company. This is what we do. And we just bought a new station in San Antonio, and we're going to impose our new album rock format on San Antonio that has been so successful for us in New York, Detroit, and Chicago. And obviously, you know, it doesn't work because you can't impose something like IBM coming in and, you know, this is our corporate culture. We're going to set it up here because this is the way it's always worked. And this,
right.
And this is a universal solution. What are some of the problems that you saw, difficulties that you saw that could have been averted if the U.S. Army, the U.S. military, in going into a situation had been more flexible instead of imposing, you know, this is the way we do things because this is who we are?
So in terms of improving what they could have done, there are any number of things that already exist, are already super powerful things. They're either social magnets or cultural. So in modern conflict, you have to master five elements. One, obviously, is military. You have to win. And you want to learn about that. You read about Don Vandegrift. But you also have to win socially, culturally, politically, and by, with, and through religion. Well, I'll use religion as an example. We are terrified to offend anybody, so we just ignore Islam. Or when we do try to work with it, we try to say, how do we make these mullahs do what we want them to do? And that is the wrong way to approach the whole problem. So I'm going to give you a story, and I've written about this. You can read about it on my website. But I want to take and make a short snapshot of this story. So we were asked, my partner, Dr. Richard Ledet and I, we were asked to go out and study education in this area and help us to get it right, because we had created enough influence that now we had by-name taskings. Okay, so we go and look. So we go back to a relationship that we already have with an established government Afghan leader, and we've got a tested and validated relationship where we know there's trust. So he says to us, I understand what you're trying to do. You need to talk to these two guys, and I'm going to put you in contact with them, and I'm going to vouch for you. And that's going to get you on your way. You know, and so now we know we're going in through a cultural appropriate door where this is peer-to-peer on the Afghan side. This is not us imposing our thing. And what often happens in general in a new cultural situation for us, we lose our bearing. Like, we do things that are forcing because we just don't know what else to do, and our mouth is agape, and we're just overloaded, so we barge in. We don't make appointments. So we know that these guys have to worry about contact with Americans. And so we say, when we call them, you know, yeah, you know, we're from Zarif. You've talked to him. We would love to meet with you. When is a good and appropriate time to meet with you? And they would set a meeting, and they would establish where it was. And we would say, okay, great. You know, what do you need from us? Nothing else. Just show up at this time, this place. And so it happened to be on an American compound. They felt they could get there safely. But now my job is to say, these are important Afghans that are coming onto the American compound. Americans, you will not frisk these guys. You will let them on as guests of the commander. And you don't get to do that until you have the appropriate influence with the command. So now these guys say, wait a second, we're being treated like the elders that we are. Okay. So everything's cultural, everything's smooth, and it's not fast. They bring with them a mullah, which is vital for them. They can't do anything without religious validation. It's not appropriate for us to bring the mullah. It's appropriate for them. So now we talk about education and what it means. And over the course of a number of meetings, we get to the point where the Afghan Minister of Education is in the room with elders and a religious leader, and they say, this is how we should approach this project. This is where we need your help, Americans. We need your expertise in how to study the effect of this program. Help us understand the things that we just simply can't do. When it comes to dealing with the people and the tribes and the religion, leave that to us. Okay, great. Do you mind if we study those things so we can better understand? Yes, we would love for you guys to learn more about us. We love that you're having this conversation with us. So the results of these meetings were this. The Minister of Education said, under no circumstances are you to bring books to kids. It is too dangerous. Under no circumstances are you to bring books to me. It is too dangerous. I will come to you, and I will grab the books. Never show up in my office with army trucks. It's too dangerous.
Hmm.
Okay. And the elders say, yes, we want to see this guy do his job, because we need to see our government do something for us, and we don't believe in him. But he's in the room, so we're going to give him a chance. And the religious leader says, all this is copacetic. I like what you guys are doing. This is all respectful and within the bounds of Islam. So that report is sent out. Everybody gets it. Everybody knows about it. It's a big win for Rich and I. We leave the theater because our time in theater is done, and now we're back at home. Fast forward a year, and there's a woman from the State Department, Ann Smedjinghoff, mm-hmm. and she goes on a patrol to deliver books to kids, and they're attacked, blown up, and killed. So it's that's how challenging the environment is. The arrogance and the ignorance of the State Department, of Ann and her peers, got themselves into a situation that they couldn't get out of. And who knows the trigger for that horrible situation. But when John Kerry speaks about it, he says, look at these – he didn't say animals, but look at these monsters. You know, mm-hmm. here we are bringing you education, but it's so wrong. The approach was, look how delicate Rich and I had approached the problem and how much cultural validation we had. And it wasn't about our success. It was an area where the government could do something for the people, which is so rare. I could tell you 100 stories about that. The elders see that we respect what they do. So when they hear, the elders work on their phone. And we talk to them, you constantly have them to deal with phone interruptions because they are the critical communication node, which also tells us we're in the right spot. Mm-hmm. And so if someone says, hey, there's going to be some bad guys doing some bad things, those guys can influence that. They may not be able to turn it off, but they can say, not today, not this time. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm.
but if we disregard them, and I would use terms more colorful typically, but if we completely ignore their direct guidance after they met with us, well, what would stop them from saying, yeah, you know what, go ahead, screw those guys, they don't care. And so you repeat that lesson every year, year after year after year. Hmm. And how hard is it to get an elder to buy off on what you're trying to do? Like, how you're not just doing damage control, you're just trying to polish a turd, honestly, a lot of times.
Mm. When you talk about danger, you know, delivering mm-hmm. books to the office of the tribal leader, he's talking about danger to him, right?
Yes. Yeah. He doesn't want Americans there. First off, we come unannounced. We don't set appointments, which is odd in any profession.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even in sales that, you know, clearly that was something that you have to do. You don't show up in a buyer's office unannounced, especially if it's an important client.
Why would you put that person in danger unless you were just an arrogant jerk, you know?
Yeah.
So these things confound us every day, every single, and I've not even talked about the messaging aspect, but that's how difficult and complex. This isn't a knock on the Department of Defense or State Department. Yes, they make mistakes, but this is extraordinarily hard work to create stability in an area that's unstable inherently.
Hmm. Is it a cultural thing in the State Department? Is it sort of a systemic thing that is spanned,
yes.
you know, more than just the current administration? Is it just sort of ingrained that we can go and as the not to be too offensive, but almost as though we were you know, the Great White Father coming and presenting blankets and trinkets to the Native Americans and you know, in order to sway the poor savages over to our side.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfair for me to paint with this big of a brush, but the State Department can take it, I'm sure. So I will say this. Yes, they hire extraordinarily smart people, people from the Kennedy School of Government. They are wonderfully talented people, and they can never be wrong. Okay, that's the
yeah,
problem,
yeah.
is that you cannot do this work without being wrong a large portion of the time. You will make mistakes. You will impose your intelligence and your desires on something that you can't, like, that's the thing I always remind myself of is the test. What am I doing wrong? Am I imposing me into this? Yes. Yeah. Like, I've seen results of it. I've seen things where I'm like, oh my God, look, I created this. Oh my gosh. You know, I've overpowered this governor. I need to tease him out in an area where it's ultra conservative. I can't put me or my intelligence into that until they say, hey, what do you think about this? Right. So, and I'll give you just a quick example. So we're sitting in a government center with a governor that we're trying to get to do things. And this is the same area where the commander said, there's something going on. So among the, something's going on is USAID and Department of State sitting there talking to this governor, and they're discussing this building, and the governor says, I want to build a school for girls here, or actually use this building for a girls' school. And they openly mock this guy at a public meeting and say, no, governor, this is going to be the demonstration farm. This is not going to be the school for girls. And he says, no, it's going to be a school for girls. That's why I'm going to put that there. And then they just, again, openly mock him. And so the State Department guy leaves his card with the governor. And the governor takes the card and picks his teeth with it.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I don't have to explain that to let you see the contempt that that guy has for the State Department guy. So State Department people are very smart, but you have to allow them to be smart. And I'm really big on this with culture. You know, everybody wants to, you have to give things that they cannot help but do and like. So, like, everybody in the world doesn't want their kid to get cancer.
Right.
That's a universal thing. Everybody loves ice cream. That's why I'm big on ice cream. If you break bread with somebody else, like, I always encourage business leaders, like, yes, take them out to a fancy restaurant, but better, go get an Airbnb and make dinner with them in your style. Have them do it in their style the next day. It's so, so much more powerful than going to Arby's or, you know, Chez Lafitte or something. You know, it doesn't matter. Go cook and eat with them, because that's so much more powerful culturally. So when it comes to State Department people, they lack the ability to be wrong, and they can't allow someone else to be smart. They might have both have the same idea, but they'll overpower the idea because they know the answer. Oh, I know the answer. Like, I would all the time tell my interpreters, if I ask a question that's crazy and seems wrong, that's something I already know, I want you to ask that question. I'm creating space for that person to teach me about Islam, even though I know about Islam. I know about the night of the day, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And my interpreter would forget. And he would look at me like, but you know this. And I would say, I know I know this. I need you to ask him so he can tell me. And they'd be like, oh, that's right, Mr. Pete, I'm sorry. And they would ask the question. And then the guy could say, let me tell you about Islam. Let me tell you about my people. Now I've drawn him out.
Right, right.
Into an area. Yeah, so you get that. That's a sales thing.
Exactly, yes. And that was one of the hardest things for me to learn, because I do have a tendency to want to impress people with the depth and breadth of my knowledge, and forgetting that the best thing you can do to draw someone out is to ask them about things that are important to them and have them teach you. And it was only a turning point for me was when I went back to my broadcast career before sales and said, you know what, if I applied what I was doing on the air when I hosted the talk show to what I'm doing when I go into a guy's office, I might get more results. So
you know what, when we do our podcast, well, I did a Negro League Museum the other day. My job is to get that guy going and get out of the way. And I don't want him on his main script. I want him off his script. But once I get him over just left of his script, I'm just nudging. I'm just guiding and letting him do all the work, because it's not about me. It's about that person.
Exactly right. The best success, if you had to look back on the time you had in conflict zones, what was the best example or the most satisfying example of a successful cultural interaction?
You know, whenever I hear that question, I have a standard answer I give, and I give it for a reason, because this is how challenging this stuff is. There is no legacy when you leave. The things that we believe we've done, the pictures that we have, the Turner challenge is this. Let's get some money, some airline tickets, backpacks, let's go, and I will show you your legacy. It's not there. So we have to look at it from a point of view of it's 1,000 tiny little wins. There's no grand win. All that stuff fades away as soon as you leave, because instability is the norm. With that said, I can go back to any of the areas I've worked in, and I can be safe, culturally safe, protected by the elders I've dealt with because of how I've approached them. I can work in any cultural environment and be safe. That's my legacy, is I've learned this craft where it doesn't matter where I go, what I do in that environment, I'll be protected because I do what's normal for them, and I bring me, but I don't just bring me.
I was reading some of the work at your blog, and you related a story where one of the elders you'd been meeting with for some time kind of surprised you, because you thought you were on really good terms with this fella, and then he sits back and says, ah, I know what you're doing now. You're trying to help us with the Americans. How much of a surprise was that to you at that point?
I was floored. I really thought that I had broken, this is a guy with years of experience. I really thought that I had, and I believe in testing, right? And it just reminded me once again that, oh my gosh, I really don't know. I've got to find more measures for more trust. So I broke down trust into different categories and said, okay, I've satisfied this one. But, you know, like extending, like we're Americans, we can extend trust. We invite people to our house all the time to do podcasts. That's, mm-hmm. that's crazy, you know? So, but you've got to find like, not just extending trust, but trust with dangerous consequences, like him vouching for us with elders. You know, that's dangerous for him. That's dangerous for them. So that's a real measure of trust. And we hadn't earned that until that day. And that's when I was able to go back and get those elders to meet with us. So absolutely floored me and reminded me once again that this is slow, delicate work that you have to do right, not fast. And if all I did the whole year was establish trust and handed that trust off to somebody else, that'd be enough if that person was competent and able to help that leader out.
Hmm.
That's how hard this stuff is.
How long had you been meeting with this gentleman when he said that, made that statement?
We've known each other for 6 months, probably met over 100 times.
Over 100 meetings?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And 'cause he thought I was reporting back negative things about him to the to the Americans. I mean, that's his last hurdle he had to get over. And what he didn't get was I really was trying to empower him. Huh. And the Americans were getting it to their credit. They were saying, yes, we get it. We understand. We're going to let this guy run the show. You know, even if it's rigged, it's not a puppet rigging. It's like, hey, you're going to perform this duty in front of the elders. Because that guy's job is to collect elders. If we're not allowing him to collect elders, that governor's not increasing his influence. Hmm. So that's what we started looking for as our measure of success is how far away do these guys come from? Who could he reach out and get? Who could he not reach out and get? Now, how do you fix that?
Hmm.
So we use the radio and other things to see how far people are coming from, what messages they brought, what if they brought him problems or complaints, you know, because there's a difference. And all of those things slowly allow that governor to trust us. Because our norm is to say, here, governor, you're going to have these 5 meetings a week. We're going to solve these problems. This is our commander's agenda. And I've had great meaning military people say, I don't care about the governor's agenda. My boss wants this.
Mm.
And that goes in the book and that goes right up to the boss because the boss will push their boss's belly button and say, knock that crap off. And now they're going to do what not what I say, but what the governor says, mm-hmm. you know? So the trust building is, well, it's critical. Mm. You can't skip it.
Mm. Now, in the last segment of the program here, I want to kind of shift gears and bring it back to your work here on this continent. How do you translate your experience as a counterintelligence officer and as a, however you describe what you were doing in Afghanistan, to the corporate world?
Well, like I said before, in a corporate world, there are tribes. HR is a tribe. The leadership is a tribe. And there are intents and outcomes that you want to have happen. So if you're a CEO, I'm going to give you an example of an actual thing that happened. So Pacific Gas and Electric, the power company in California, was trying to hire a veteran to be a liaison to other veterans and say, hey, PG&E is a safe place to work. You guys should come and work here. And they're trying with great intent to hire veterans. I apply for this job. I've got a master's degree. I've got all these qualifications. I get a response back from PG&E that says, you fail to meet the minimum requirements for this job. Well, first off, that's not correct. Second, that's code in military speak for I am a piece of crap. Mm. I am mm-hmm. fat. I am lazy. I am not even doing the minimum. And so I sent an email to the CEO saying, hey, look, I know this isn't the outcome you want. And sure enough, he responds by sending it over to his head of HR saying, this is not the outcome I want. Why is this guy sending me an email and why are we not talking to him? And so that turns into an interaction where you start to make progress. So in the business world, it's culture, again, is everywhere. It's like gravity. It's all around you. And so you can have things that are confounding your success, that are creating inefficiency, that are creating, grass is greener is a cultural thing, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Interdepartmental squabbles. You know, HR wants to hire somebody for a specific reason. So they'll say, this person is cheaper, right? But the engineering guy will say, I need a journeyman engineer because it's going to take me 150 hours just to get this guy to where I can leave him alone and check on his work as opposed to just leave him alone. Like, it's cheaper and easier, and I'm more productive if I do that. Well, those are cross purposes there.
Right.
And I don't know what the right answer is, but until they can sit down and go, I see what you're trying to do, you know, they can now internally negotiate more effectively because they have a common view of the same situation.
Hmm. My dad told me something he observed when he was working at Motorola back in the early to mid-60s. He said it was bizarre watching managers who would pad their bottom line by making sure that they got their bonus at the end of the year by bringing costs for their department under under budget, by laying people off right before the holidays, you know, after Thanksgiving. He said there'd always be layoffs. And so the managers would get their bonuses, but then you'd have a bunch of really angry people who'd been laid off during the holidays and then wonder why productivity wasn't great because morale in the on the factory floor was low. The managers had their own agenda and motivations that didn't really correspond to what the organization as a whole was trying to accomplish.
Right.
Is that kind of what you're trying to that gap that you're trying to close?
Yeah, absolutely. You're talking exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you have these things where you come out and you're like, this is not my intended outcome. I don't intend, you know, the Department of Labor numbers are clear. Most people are disengaged every day at work.
Yeah.
If you can improve that by 10%, whatever that number is, then you've got a substantially more efficient operation. And a lot of times I know, like I worked at a large corporation in between my military years where they would work really hard, spend a lot of money to hire excellent people, and then the turnover rate was 80%+, and they would have these great people that I would follow later on LinkedIn, and I'd see that they're like directors of things and vice president of things, and like, this person quit in a rage from this company, you know, because their usefulness wasn't identified. So this company would spend all this time and effort to find great people. They would actually find them, but they would realize their greatness in a different company. And I know that isn't what the CEO wants.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to find those. And that's what I do is I go out and identify, like, look at these people. I would do that. I would go out and look at, tell me who's all worked here the last 5 years. And I would start looking around LinkedIn and say, look, these people here are in charge of big things. You know, what are we doing here? Why are we losing so many people? You know, another example of this is I talked to a guy that worked overseas a lot. And I said, you know, what kind of training were you given before you worked in these cross-cultural, international, cross-religious kind of environments? He's like, cross-religious? I'm not worried about that. And I'm like, well, there's problem number one. And so he's like, you know, I figured it out. I know what to do now. You know, I through my work and everything. And I'm like, you don't think that someone like me could teach you anything about it? He's like, not really, because I'm already done it a lot. And then the next sentence out of his mouth, he's like, I've got this Indian partner that will never do what I tell him to do. And I'm like, you have a cultural problem, my friend, right? Because there's a mutual misunderstanding. And what it basically boils down to is that there are certain behaviors that you get when you make a certain cultural mistake. And if you don't understand their decision process, their need, and they likewise don't understand yours, you're both going to do what you want to do, and you're going to get what looks like passive-aggressive behavior. And so instead of saying, oh, wait, there's probably a problem here that I'm causing or that I'm missing, and stopping and saying, when I ask you to show up, you don't show up, you know, and I don't know how you ask this question necessarily, but in this case, you know, what happens? What are we missing? And have the guy say, well, you have to understand that you're asking me to do something, and culturally I have to say yes to you because you're my boss. But in reality, I'm never going to follow up on that. And that doesn't bother me because what you're, you know, how you're asking me, you know, whatever the problem is, it's there and it's illustratable.
How often do you see that in the businesses that you analyze, the clients that who bring you in for your expertise? I mean, is this a universal problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that there's always something that's gnawing at the company in a cultural sense, and they might identify or misidentify something. And typically what I'll say is I'm going to see what I see. I'm going to go with a clean slate, and I'm going to describe what I find. So I like to say I'll walk a mile in their shoes. So I'll put on their shoes, and I walk a mile in them, and I say, this is what their life looks like. So companies are really big on user experience, which is a great thing, but also employee experience. You know, why are my employees so disengaged? Well, let me go find out, you know? And it's like, oh, well, you know, you guys insult them every day because these, you know, whatever it's going to be. And there's always tales. And I typically never have to provide a recommendation because, again, I can't outdo them. They know their company. Once I show them the ground truth, they'll instantly have ideas on how to change what they're doing. You know, I'll be in part of that process, but I rarely have to come up with my own idea. They will instinctively know their company well enough to know this is where I need to make these changes. And then, you know, I'll stay on and I'll continue to look into that with them, and off they go. They've moved well past that within a short amount of time because, you know, I can't out IBM an IBMer, you know, mm-hmm. But I can't tell them what it looks like to be them.
Yeah. Once you remove the blinders, help the scales fall from their eyes, then the solution probably presents itself.
It quite often does, because what the CEO can't do is they can't go to the ground and see what's there. Mm. There's just too much influence there. I can go and be basically invisible. I can use my spy techniques and blend in and say, what are you, you know, what's going on with your life? Tell me about you, and just allow them to give me their culture. And then I just reflect that back and you put some analysis in there, and they say, I get it. I see what to do. Let's make some changes. And it's always, always the case that the cost paid to me is insignificant compared to the value that they see in what I bring to them. Always.
You know, I'm glad you made that observation. I wish I'd thought of that question. How does your background as a spy help you in corporate consulting?
Yeah, right. It makes sense, but that's exactly what I do. I can go into the bar and have a conversation, and I can win trust because I've studied how to win trust. You know, like people will say, build rapport, right? You've done sales, build rapport, build trust. Okay, how do I do that? And then how do I measure that it's right? Well, I have those tools. I've developed them, but I've developed them in a place where people want to shoot me in the face. On both sides of what I did. You know, the Army hates me as much as the Afghans do, you know, but I found a way to say these things work, you know, and it's a step-by-step process.
Yeah, that's the one thing I never had to experience as an outside salesman. Neither the customers nor the inside sales staff were typically, you know, armed. So,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Pete, your podcast, the Break It Down Show, it looks to me like you've got a pretty diverse guest list there. What do you focus on that program, and where do people find that program?
www.breakitdownshow.com. We're on iTunes, breakitdownshow.com. Just if you type in Break It Down Show, you will find us all over the place. We do grab, we seek to create a mosaic or a tapestry, depending on how you look at it. But we build that tapestry thread by thread. So some days it's a red thread, and some days it's a baby blue thread. And you don't realize you want a baby blue thread until you meet that person who is that person. So instead of, like one of the guys I worked with in Iraq wrote a bestseller. He's an interpreter from Iraq, and his name's Johnny Walker. And they're making a movie about his life. So he goes on this book tour and does these little 7-minute interviews that tell nothing about his incredible story. Well, that's not good enough. You know, like I'm going to sit down with you for an hour, hour and a half, and we're going to tell your story to all these people. And it's incredible to hear these things. So we've got musicians that have been notable, famous front of the band people, but we've also had the guy in the background that's like, I played with James Brown. I played with Aretha Franklin. I did, you know, and you're like, these lives are so rich. One of my best friends growing up has been, it's unfair to call him a roadie, but he works on a road crew for the Eagles and for Green Day.
Oh, wow.
And to hear him talk about the detail and the importance of what he does, because basically he makes sure that on the road that Joe Walsh knows exactly where his pants are. So when he wants to wear the blue pants with the red trim, he doesn't have to freak out and say, where is it? Because when you think about your own life and how normal, like when I can't find my keys before I have to go somewhere,
right,
I lose my mind.
Yeah.
Joe Walsh can't do that. He's got people paying all of their money to come watch him play. He needs to be worried about that show. And so Scott does all these incredible things to make sure that all Joe Walsh has to do is grab his guitar and go on stage and feel great. So that's what we try to do, is try to illustrate these things that are incredible stories with incredible people. And oftentimes they don't realize how incredible they are, even if they're noteworthy. And it's just a blast. It's a ride. And anybody who's interested in it, I know you'll find a show that you like, because we talk to warriors, we talk to authors, Grammy winners, Emmy winners, all kinds of people, but also people that just do incredible things in life.
BreakItDownShow.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes at VFTB.net. And CultureSec, your consulting firm, where do people find that?
you can just go to PeteAturner.com. You can get a hold of me there. And I'm glad to answer simple questions. I'm glad to come speak or train or whatever it is that you think you might need. If you're not sure, definitely reach out. I'm glad to have a conversation and help out in any way that I can.
All right. Pete Turner, management consultant, former spy, counterintelligence expert, and one of the people who are trying to make things easier for our men and women in uniform in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And for that, I thank you. Pete, enjoyed the conversation. I'll have to do this again.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, thank you so much. I really do. I really appreciate you taking the time and interviewing. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you.
You find links in the show notes to Pete's website, his blog, and also the Break It Down Show podcast. And those show notes are always posted at VFTB.net. That's your basic acronym, View from the Bunker, VFTB.net. And check out Pete's work. He was referred to me, as I mentioned during the interview, by Dr. Timothy Furnish, who's been a guest on this program fairly regularly over the last year or so. I stumbled onto his work while trying to understand what the Islamic State was all about and found one of his articles, which led me to his article from 2005, in which he essentially, he wouldn't use the word prophesied, but it was almost prophetic, predicted the rise of radical Mahdism, which when you understand the history of Islam, and I'm not saying that I do, but when I read his work on history, it becomes clear that the history of Islam is filled with radical Mahdist movements that brought men to power and wound up with a lot of people getting killed. So that's what's happened in the Islamic State. And understanding that this is nothing new for Islam and that this is not a bastardization or an appropriation of the work of Muhammad, but rather a return to a purer form of Islam would help explain a lot of their actions. It just made a lot of sense. It made a lot more sense than what I was hearing and reading in the so-called conservative press, which didn't really get it. You know, I will admit that 10 years ago when I was hosting a daily secular talk show on a standard issue conservative talk radio station, you know, it was me and then Sean Hannity and then Michael Savage. And earlier in the day was Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly when he was still doing daily radio. You know, I was right there with those guys marching pretty much lockstep in terms of my political views, calling the president of Iran Mahmoud Ahmadinejad instead of, you know, Ahmadinejad. But when you understand what they actually believe, as Dr. Furnish does, makes a little more sense. Well, in reading Pete Turner's work on the issues that our soldiers have had, that our military commanders have had in trying to make headway with the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, it makes sense. It begins to make sense. We can't go in and just impose our will, and we can't deal with them as we would deal with other Americans. We just have a completely different worldview. As he said, we Americans extend trust very easily because we live in a secure society. We invite people over all the time who we don't always know well because we're fairly confident that person is not bringing weapons or explosives with which to do us harm. Usually. But there in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that is a very real threat, very real fear, something they live with every day. And if we're not sensitive to that or cognizant of that even, then bad things will happen and people will die needlessly. In fact, at Pete's blog, he makes he has some very direct comments about the State Department employee who died because they did not listen to what he and his research partner had been told by the elders. Don't come to us unannounced. Don't deliver books to us. Don't deliver books to our children. It is dangerous. And sadly, for some people from the State Department, employees from the State Department, that cost them their lives. Things over there are really pretty grim. And the guys in the Islamic State, because they are true believers, are willing to justify just about any action that will move them closer to their goal of provoking that final battle at Dabiq, or perhaps at a valley near a mountain called Jabal Akra, which is the old Mount Safan, which in ancient times was the location of the Palace of Baal. Probably just a coincidence. So there are things that the Islamic State has done over the past 2 years that we in the West would consider barbaric. But it's because these guys believe God is on their side that they're justified in doing it. Things have gotten a little rough for the Islamic State of late, if this report is accurate. Once Russia entered the conflict last September and actually began bombing their black market oil convoys, it kind of shamed us into, you know, aiming at some targets of a little higher value, perhaps. Anyway, we supposedly, reportedly, I should say, we reportedly have destroyed a number of their cash storage facilities. And that has really put a hurt on the Islamic State's budget. So according to this report, ISIS has been trying to make up the shortfall in their income by selling off the organs of their own fighters. And they've been selling off the organs of their own fighters by killing the wounded so they can harvest them while they're fresh. Now, this sounds barbaric. Well, it is barbaric. There's no question about it. But one of the most underreported stories of the last couple of years, in my view, is the Chinese practice of similarly harvesting organs from political prisoners who aren't even injured at the time that they go under the knife. Or rather, I should say, they aren't injured until they go under the knife. I reached out to the author of a book on this practice. I have not heard back from him. Would like to do a program on this because I find this to be just hideous. But it is what happens in a world that so devalues human life, does not consider human life sacred simply because we are created in his image. And that doesn't mean that God is a biped about 6 foot tall. You know, I'll say this at the risk of repeating myself. You've probably heard me say this before if you've listened for any length of time. We are God's agents on earth. We represent his image on earth. We have dominion over the earth in the same way God has dominion over all of creation. When you understand the nuances of the Hebrew, say the Hebrew scholars, that's really what it means. As such, human life is sacred. It is not utilitarian to be disposed of as soon as somebody in authority determines that it is no longer of value. And of course, those in authority get to determine what constitutes value, word in air quotes. So anyway, if this story is true, it demonstrates, number one, the demonic religion that the Islamic State is following, and number two, that perhaps they are indeed showing some effects from the onslaught, at least since the Russians got into the fight last September. This week marked the official lighting of the flame for the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. There is a photo, I see. I haven't seen video of this, but I see a photo of a woman dressed in and accompanied by attendants, all dressed in ancient Greek costume, invoking the blessing of the sun god Apollo as she uses a concave mirror to light the flame. The torch is now on a 6-day tour of Greece. It will then travel to Brazil, where it will arrive on May 3rd and begin a 100-day journey around Brazil. Some 12,000 torchbearers having a turn at carrying the torch before it arrives in Rio on August 5th for the Games. Now, as with the replica of the triumphal arch from Palmyra that was erected in London earlier this week, which was a change of plans after Christians objected to putting up a replica of the gate from the Temple of Baal, they decided to recreate the triumphal arch, which was built a couple hundred years later to honor the victory of the Emperor Septimius Severus over the Parthian Empire, or Persians. It still was part of the grand colonnade, the grand walkway that connected the Temple of Baal to the western gate at Palmyra. And in the conversation I had with Brian Godawa for Skywatch TV this week, we discussed how willingly our secular culture embraces pagan imagery because they don't see any spiritual significance or supernatural significance to it. And that's why we see so much pagan imagery in our pop culture, especially stuff that's aimed at kids, teens, young adults. I mean, it's there even when we're not really looking for it. I mean, for a whole generation of kids coming up, Thor is nothing more than a member of the Avengers. They don't get that Asgard was a real place to the Norse of 1,000 years ago. And of course, that's how the principalities and powers that the Apostle Paul wrote about manifested to our Germanic ancestors. But in our enlightened Western world, it's nothing more than our cultural heritage that needs to be preserved. And why nobody complains about a group calling itself the Soldiers of Odin showing up in Canada, apparently opening a number of chapters there, except that it demonstrates the racial bias and discrimination against poor Muslim immigrants arriving in Canada. The fact that they're naming themselves soldiers of a pagan deity gets not a mention in the news story because, again, in our culture, it's nothing more than a historical reference. So, anyway, these 12,000 torchbearers for the Olympics, all apparently blessed by the sun god Apollo, or Apollyon, if you prefer, or in the Hebrew tongue, Abaddon, which means the destroyer, the king, or the demon locusts that emerge from the pit in Revelation 9, verse 11. Well, not a surprise. As Brian mentioned earlier this week, this just demonstrates, again, that we are not moving into an enlightened age, if you will, of reason, where we're setting aside the superstition of religion. We're moving into a new pagan age as we move into a post-Christian era here in America. Next week on A View from the Bunker, the gentleman who put me in touch with Pete Turner, Dr. Timothy Furnish, he returns. He's got a new book that is due out at the end of the month. I'm getting a copy that I can start reading on my Kindle over the weekend. The Political History of Middle Earth. Is that not cool? He's also working on The Military History of Middle Earth, which will be out later this year. And we'll talk again about that. But that'll be the interview next Sunday on A View from the Bunker. The Political History of Middle Earth. What was Theoden thinking when he took on Grima Wormtongue as an advisor? And can you just imagine the conservative media of Middle Earth back in the day, the equivalent of Sean Hannity on the radio talking about these developments in Gondor? That should be a fun conversation. I look forward to that. The main focus of what Sharon and I have been doing in recent months has been the Gilbert House Fellowship. That is our weekly Bible study. I know, and we appreciate the many notes we've received asking, are you going to revive PID Radio? Because our last program on PID Radio to this date was back in January. In fact, we missed our 11th anniversary in March. But we're putting out 2 hours a week on PID Radio and then another half hour with the weekly Sci-Fry video cast on Skywatch TV. And that is really encompassing a lot of what we want to do. And we're finding that the weekly Bible study is really fulfilling and more so than I thought it was going to be honest with you. Getting a lot more out of it, and I hope you will too. We're going through the Bible chronologically in the order of the events recorded in the scriptures. That's the order in which we are reading the Bible. So the Old Testament study for any given week might include a couple of Psalms, a little from 2 Samuel, and a bit of 1 Chronicles. And the New Testament study could be from 3 or 4 different gospels in the same week. We're enjoying it, and we hope you'll get something out of it as well. Usually get those posted by midday Sunday, and you'll find the Gilbert House Fellowship online at gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse.org. This coming week on Skywatch TV, we launch a new venture, Skywatch TV, which has been doing video and audio. There is a Skywatch podcast, by the way. We also now launching Skywatch Magazine, a print magazine. We talk about that. And also the release of a new book that we hope doesn't get lost in the shuffle. We've got so much going on at Skywatch TV that we're finding it difficult to cram everything into the broadcast schedule. A new book coming out from Defender Publishing called I Predict What 12 Leading Experts Think You Will See or Believe You Will See by 2025. Sharon and I both have chapters in that book, as do writers like Joel Richardson, best-selling author of Islamic or Mideast Beast, Mark Biltz of Blood Moon's fame. Of course, Tom Horn's got a chapter in there as well. Troy Anderson, Paul McGuire, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, a number of other experts on a variety of topics. I write about what I predict the next 10 years will hold for the Temple Mount and the Ark of the Covenant. Uh-huh. So that is also coming out. That's part of the discussion next week on Skywatch TV. And for a complete listing of channels and times where you can watch Skywatch TV, you'll find it at skywatchtv.com. Look in the top menu bar there where it says channel listing. That's where we keep the schedule. And of course, the program will be online. Will be on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku by Monday morning. We appreciate your reviews and your likes. Whether you find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or the View from the Bunker Facebook page, your reviews and likes, well, frankly, they draw attention to what we're doing here, and I sure appreciate that. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.